Hi, everybody. Welcome to class number 6 in our Tanakh and Archaeology series. So what we are going to do today, last week we did kind of an overview of the first book of Samuel, right? Shmuel Aleph. This week we're going to do more an in-depth focus of Shmuel Bet, of Sefer, of the second book of Samuel. We're going to focus on the city of Jerusalem in the time of King David. But since we're there already, let's take a little bit of a longer look at some of the other things, because the city of David is really the beginnings of Jerusalem. So we're going to take a look at it even after the time of King David. The reason I chose to focus on this, first of all, the city of David is a fascinating place. But second, as we're going to see in a minute, when we look at the outline of the book, we are going to see that the book essentially focuses on the beginning is King David's rise to power. And once he consolidates his power and he rules over all of Israel, he does that from Jerusalem. He makes it a new capital, right? And most of the stories of his life, the dramas, there's going to be a lot of drama, is taking place not only in Jerusalem, but in his actual home, in his palace. And it's all surrounding his wives, his children, all these different dynamics. The book is ultimately going to end with the purchase of the land for the temple, right? So that's also focusing on Jerusalem. So it seemed appropriate to go kind of deeply into David City. Let's take a look at this picture for a minute. It's such a great picture. It's a photograph by someone named Avram Gracier, and he did such an amazing job. Take a look at what's going on here. Focused on, right, the sharper focus of the picture is the area of the city of David, right, which, as you can see, is actually outside the walls of today's old city, right? Here are the walls of today's old city. We're going to talk about that a little bit. It's between two valleys, the Kidron Valley over here, the Gai or the Taropian Valley over here. The city expands and it grows up to the Temple Mount and then over to the west. But if we want to talk about it in the time of King David, he begins in this small area. The city grows into what's called the Ophel, right? This area that today is the southern wall of the Temple Mount, but David builds up the city to there. And at the end of the book, he buys the threshing floor of Aravna, Goren Aravna, which ultimately is going to become the site for the temple. Okay. So this is really the focal point of the city, but let's clear all these little scribbles so that we can enjoy this picture for one last time. The other thing that's nice from this perspective, and we'll see it again as we go on, I think, is that you can see that the city of David, or Yevus, right, this original Jerusalem, it is actually not high up at all. It's a little hill, but it's a hill that is surrounded by much higher mountains. When you go to the city of David, this is very clear, right? To the north, you have the Temple Mount. To the east, you have the Mount of Olives. To the west, you have Mount Zion, right? To the south, you have the Hill of Evil Council, the area of the promenade of the Tayelet of today, right? Jerusalem is this. If this is Jerusalem, Jerusalem is literally surrounded by mountains. And when we talk about King David in Jerusalem, right, we won't say that King David writes the entire book of Psalms of Tehillim. There clearly are chapters, even according to the most traditional scholars, that were written by others, right? And he's more for Asaph. He's more of B'nai Korach. But there are certainly chapters that seem very clear to have been written by David and written by him in Jerusalem, right? We have this whole nice section towards the end of the book of Mizmorim about Jerusalem. And in one of them, we have this beautiful image, right, where David says, Yushalayim harim savivla. Jerusalem is surrounded by mountains. Va'adonai savivla amo. And God, as God surrounds his people, right? This very, very beautiful image of the city kind of being encircled or embraced by mountains, just like God encircles and embraces the people. That doesn't work if Jerusalem is all the way up on the Temple Mount or up on the Mount of Olives, but it works very nicely over here because you really do have mountains all around. Okay, so let's go on. Let's get a little bit, just a look at the book, even though, like I said, we're not going to be focusing on the stories of the book so much this time, but but it's good to have an overview. Okay, so the first chapter, we mentioned this last time, the first chapter really belongs much more to the previous book, and it only becomes two books much later in history, right? But the first chapter is David gets the news about the loss in the battle, the defeat, and how Saul and Jonathan are killed. He recites his beautiful lamentation, his kina, right? But that seems very much connected to the stories we've had in previous chapters. But then from chapter two, we dive in, right? And we get very succinctly in three chapters, essentially a chronicle of the 7.5 years that we know David rules in Hebron, where he rules only over the tribe of Judah. And that's where you have this real conflict, this real, it doesn't get to the extent of a civil war, but there certainly is a battle for succession. Who is going to take over from King Saul? King Saul rules over all the people, more or less. Okay. But when he dies, there are those who want to follow David, especially from the tribe of Judah. And there are those who are looking in Saul's camp for a leader, right? Saul's son, Ish-bosheth, is not a worthy leader, but the general who kind of is the power behind the throne, Avner ben Ner, is a worthy leader. Eventually, Avner comes to parley with David. They are almost, they have an agreement. It seems like everybody's going to be united. And then David's general, Yoav, murders Avner, and all of that comes crashing to a close, right? So we have this back and forth of who's going to be in control. But by chapter five, right, David manages to vanquish his enemies, to unite the people, and to conquer Jerusalem and make Jerusalem the capital of all of Israel, right? And it says it very, we'll see this a little bit later, that when David was king in Hebron, it says he was king over Judah. When he was king in Jerusalem, he was king over all of Israel and of Judah, right? It's the place that unites the people. The first act that he does as king in Jerusalem is to bring the ark, right? Remember from two classes ago, the ark was in exile, taken by the Philistines, brought back, put in places for safekeeping. He brings it to Jerusalem. He wants to build the temple. God says, you're not the one. Your son's going to build the temple. We have a few chapters, 7, 8, 9, 10, basically fighting different enemies, whether it's Ammon or the Philistines, right? And kind of doing all the various kingly things, okay? But chapter 11 is the turning point of the book, right? Chapter 11 is David's terrible sin, right? He sees this beautiful woman, Bathsheba. He brings her to his house. He sleeps with her. She's a married woman. She becomes pregnant. He's in a very bad situation, and he essentially arranges for the murder of her husband, who's one of his soldiers. And it's a terrible, terrible story. The rabbis in the Gemara, I won't say try to whitewash it, but have a lot of trouble with the story and try to interpret it in various ways. But if you read the story just plain the way it is, it's a terrible story. And it is clearly a turning point in the book. If up until this point, David is the hero, right? He's the underdog. He's the one who fights all these righteous battles, and he becomes king, and he is the king. He's the legitimate king. At this point, he's forgiven. His line remains the kingly line, but his personal life completely falls apart. And that's what's happening in the next few chapters. So in chapter 12, we have the confrontation, right? The prophet Nathan comes to David. He tells him the very famous story of the sheep, right? The poor man who has only one sheep, and the rich man who has many sheep takes the poor man's sheep and serves it for dinner. Right. And David is very, very upset. How could you do such a thing? And Natan says, that's you. You're the man who stole the sheep. And this is a very powerful thing. Even though his sins are much worse than King Saul, his reaction is much better, right? King Saul, as we saw last week, whenever he is confronted by Samuel the prophet, you did this wrong, you did that wrong, he always is full of excuses. David immediately says, I was wrong. Right? I was wrong. Forgive me. It doesn't change the fact that he did a terrible thing, but he immediately acknowledges that he was wrong. He repents, and that's why his line is able to continue. But it's very clear from the rest of the book that he's going to be punished in his household for what happens. So you have the kind of cascading events of his children. You know, his he has a lot of wives, so he has a lot of half brothers and sisters, right? So you have Amnon who rapes Tamar, and then Avshalom who avenges Tamar's rape by murdering Amnon. He runs away. He's brought back. He rebels against David, and David has to run away, run for his life, right? Avshalom is eventually defeated and killed. And this is terrible, terrible devastation for David, who truly loves Avshalom. So all of these chapters from 13 through 19, conflicts within the house, very much a reflection of a punishment for David. Chapter 20, we have another terrible thing that happens, but it ends a little bit better. This is an outsider, Sheva ben Bichri, who rebels against David. We have the very strange and unsettling story in chapter 21 of the Givonim, who want revenge on King Saul. We don't exactly know why. The commentaries talk about all sorts of things, but basically David gives up some of the sons of King Saul's concubine, Rizpah bat Aya, and he has them killed by the Givonim. And Rizpah bat Aya does this very noble thing by staying with the bodies, even though they aren't buried, and protecting them. And this kind of shames David into bringing back Saul and Jonathan's bones and burying them. It's a very strange and upsetting story. And we have two chapters of kind of like roundup, right? There's songs of praise, there's lists of warriors. And finally, we have the very big bang end of the book, right? There's a terrible disease. The disease, the plague ends with an angel standing. We have two versions of this in the book of Samuel and the book of Chronicles, right? So we put the story together. An angel is standing on the area of what we call the Temple Mount. David understands this is a signal to buy this place. He buys it and therefore sets in motion what's going to become eventually King Solomon's temple. Okay. And that's essentially the end of David's story. We're going to have a few chapters in the book of Kings that are going to deal with the end of David's life, right? Where he is as an old man and the story of succession. But here is where we really get the sense of him as a king and what he accomplishes. So that's just to give us our general outline. Now let's get back to our Ir David. Okay. So where are we talking about, right? We saw this in the photograph, but let's see it in the map is also helpful. So the city of David, let's understand here are the walls of the old city, right? You can see them kind of outlined here, right? We don't need to go all the way around, but you understand what I'm saying, right? And here's the city of David outside the walls. Okay, which you will say is very strange. Why should the oldest part of the city be outside the walls of the old city? That's because it wasn't always outside the walls of the old city. The walls of the old city used to go all the way down here and around and up, right? When did this change? This changed about 1,000 years ago. The Muslim rulers of Jerusalem, who had to rebuild the city, decided not to go all the way down into the valley and back up because it was a pain. And so they left this part out. But really, originally, this is part of the walled city. It's the only city, really. This is the beginnings of the city. Then it goes and expands to include the Temple Mount and ultimately becomes bigger and bigger. Why is the city down here? As we're going to see, because of the water. Okay, that's very important. The other important things in terms of topography is like we said, the valleys, right? Kidron Valley on this side, Haggai or the Teropian Valley on this side, Mount of Olives over here. And your eye might be drawn to where it says here, King David's tomb. How is this King David's tomb, right? This is on Mount Zion. This is a problematic thing because the book of Kings said that King David is buried in the city of David. And this is clearly not in the city of David. Is this really King David's tomb? Is it not? There are disagreements. Most scholars agree that this is the tomb of the descendants of King David, right? Of his great-great-grandchildren, the later kings of the house of David. Okay, not super important for us right now, but important, but interesting to know. Okay, so just to place ourselves to understand where we are, here's the Western Wall, right? Here's the Jewish Quarter. So hopefully you know where you are when you are looking at that map. Today, the area that's called the City of David, like we said, outside the walls, go outside of Dung Gate of Shar HaShpot, the wall, the gate that's closest to the Western Wall. You walk a little down the hill and you go into an area that today is called the City of David. It's a place of tons and tons and tons of excavations that started there in the middle of the 19th century and are still going on today. It's a very dynamic place. There's always something new that is happening. Today it is very much next to and within the Arab neighborhoods of Wadi Khilwa and Silwan. Silwan is across the valley. Wadi Khilwa is where the City of David is itself. So this is a complicated place also on a political level. Today, the area of the City of David is a national park, right? And very much kind of plays up these biblical connections. So when you walk in, you have this very nice harp, right? David plays the harp. You also have, I don't know why I didn't put it in the picture, I apologize, but above it says in Hebrew, Ir David, but it also says in the old Hebrew script, Ir David, right? David in the ancient, in the Ketav Ivri letters, the old letters that are used in First Temple times. And I brought you here this, so we'll talk about this a little, not too much, because I did a whole zoom on it last year. But the question of King David in biblical archaeology, right, and how legitimate a king he is. And there's a period in the 70s, 80s, where there's a school of scholarship that basically says King David, he's like King Arthur. He's a mythological figure. He doesn't actually exist. All those nice stories that are written about in the prophets, they're all meant to aggrandize the later kingdom of Judah, but they have nothing to do with any real figures. This all was essentially, this theory came crashing down when in the early 90s, in the north of Israel, in a place called Tel Dan, an archaeologist named Avraham Biran discovered fragments of a monumental stela, right? What the kings would write, I beat this guy and I beat that guy, right? This is from a king of Aram, of the Arameans. He's writing in our nice ancient Hebrew because this is the alphabet that everybody uses in our area. And he writes about how he conquers so-and-so, the king of Israel, Yoram, the king of Israel, and the king from, I don't know if you can see these letters that are outlined in white, Beit David, right? The triangles, the deltas, that's a Dalit. Beit David. Now, this, we date this based on the date of the Aramean king and also the style of letters. This goes back to the 9th century, right? King David has always traditionally been ascribed to the 10th century before the Common Era, 3,000 years ago. This is 2,900 years ago. If there was a house of David 2,900 years ago, chances are good that there was a David 3,000 years ago. So once this was discovered, basically everybody said, yes, 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 there was a King David, but how great a king was he? That we'll get to a little bit later. Okay, but these are our ancient Hebrew letters. And they are revived on the sign here. Okay, let's continue. So Jerusalem is an interesting choice for a city. And when I say interesting, I mean bad. Okay, it's a bad choice for a city. Among other problems that it has, it doesn't have a great water supply, right? We have the Gihon spring, but that's a very piddling little spring. Okay. It is not so easy to defend. We saw all the other mountains around are higher. Okay. It's not on the main road, right? Remember our road. We mentioned this, I think, when we talked about Shiloh, right? This Derech Ha'avot, this path of the patriarchs, the path that goes through the mountains, this blue line, as opposed to the Via Maris, the sea road, right? This is a very important road. Jerusalem is a little bit off to the side. And you may remember when we talked, about the story of the Pilegesh B'Giv'ah, right? The terrible rape that happens in Giv'ah. The man who's traveling says, oh, we're not going to go off the road to Yevus, right? That's not on the main road. We'd have to go off the road to get there, besides the fact that it's not a Jewish town, right? It's not an Israelite town. So Jerusalem is not on the main road. It doesn't have a lot of water. It's not easy to defend. And perhaps most important, it's kind of nice when your capital city belongs to your kingdom, okay? And Jerusalem was not known as Jerusalem. It was known as Yevus because it was ruled by the Yevusim, the Jebusites, a Canaanite nation. And why would anybody choose this to be their capital? It doesn't seem to make much sense, right? As Jerusalem expands, by the way, it kind of comes to encompass the main road, but certainly in David's time, it's a little bit off the road. We'll come back to why he chooses it in a moment, but just again, to understand the topography, it's just a nice little topographical map between the valleys. It's like a nice long U shape or a tongue shape. So you've got these valleys. The valleys are a defensive help, right? It's hard to scale to the top of the mountain because you're way down in the valley. So it's not that it's completely indefensible, but there would be better choices, right? Why do they choose to put it down here as opposed to on top of the mountain? Because as we said, this is where the water is. So you have this Kidron Valley over here. You have another valley, the Turopian Valley over here. And you have a third valley, the Hinnom Valley, that kind of swings around, wraps around from the south to the west. Okay. The only part of the city that doesn't have valleys near it is the northern part. And that makes the northern part the most vulnerable. We'll come to that when we get up to Jeremiah and the destruction of Jerusalem in the time of Babylonia, of the Babylonians. All right. Let's take a look for a minute at the history of the city, right? The timeline of the city, because it's a very old city. Okay. Jerusalem is already an important city in the time of the early Canaanites, okay? We have letters, the Elamarna letters, letters that are written by the Canaanite kings to the Egyptians already in the 19th century before the Common Era, okay? In the 14th century before the Common Era, okay? We hear about Jerusalem. Jerusalem is important. This is just to give us kind of a little bit of a perspective, but realize that Jerusalem is about at least 5,000 years old. Okay. It's an Israelite city since 3,000 years ago, but it's a Canaanite city for the first part of its existence. Okay. So from around 3150 BCE until the time of King David, or maybe the time of Joshua, we have a Canaanite city. We're going to talk about the water, right? The tunnel, the spring house, the Jebusites build this incredible system to protect the water. Okay. From around 1200, we have this group that are kind of specialized Canaanites, right? We hear about them as the Jebusites. We don't hear about them earlier. They might have been there earlier. We don't really have that much detail from this time. Around the year 1000, King David conquers Jerusalem. Some people may remember about 20 years ago, they did a whole thing, 3000 year birthday of Jerusalem as a Jewish city, right? So nobody knows the exact date, but we have an idea, right? The next generation, King Solomon comes along, builds the first temple. Hey, more than 100 years later, right, you have the city has expanded and has grown and is going to be under attack by the Assyrians. So King Hezekiah comes along 200 years later, digs Hezekiah's tunnel, digs the wall. We're going to talk about all these things, but the city has already expanded by then, only to crash and burn in the time of the Babylonians, where we have two levels of exile. 597, the elite and the king are exiled. 11 years later, the temple is destroyed and another group is sent into exile. But already in 539, the Babylonians have fallen to the Persians. Cyrus the Great allows the rebuilding and the return of the return to Zion. Now, there's a lot more history here, right? City of David is important in Second Temple times. It's important later. We'll talk a little bit about that at the end, but we want to focus on Tanakh times, right? That's what's important to us right now. Okay. And let's understand, what are we looking at? So if you've ever gone to the City of David, you have seen this pile of rocks, which is not very picturesque, but it's pretty important. Hey, this is one of the most important archaeologists to dig in the City of David, who dug there in the 50s when it was under the control of Jordan, was Dame Kathleen Kenyon, a British archaeologist, very good archaeologist. Didn't like Jews or Israel, but she was a good archaeologist. And she digs up this area, which is called Area G, right? Archaeological pieces are given letters or numbers. And she uncovers all sorts of interesting things, right? We really want to focus on this kind of squiggly wall that goes all the way down. She calls it the stepped stone structure. It's not an actual wall. It's a foundation for something much larger that was built up on top, right? And we're going to read the passage that talks about David's conquest of Jerusalem, and it talks about how he comes to Mitsudat Zion, okay? The fortress of Zion. Fortress of Zion seems to be a structure at the top of the hill, impregnable, right? With this massive foundation all the way at the top of the hill, okay? and able to be a lookout and to protect the rest of the city. We're going to come back to the different parts of this picture, but I'm just going to show you one or two things here. Okay. These things are not contemporary with each other, right? The stepstone structure and the fortress are from the time of the Jebusites up to the time of King David. Okay. This second piece here is part of a house called the House of Achiel, okay, from a few hundred years later, okay, with a very lovely toilet in its courtyard. Okay. We're going to come back to that. And there's another piece down here that had all kinds of boule, of seal impressions that are from the end of First Temple times. And we also have evidence of destruction, of ashes, of arrowheads. So we really have the story of the city from the time of the Jebusites and the conquest through First Temple times up until the end of the city when the Babylonians come and conquer. So we're going to come back to these various pieces, but I just wanted you to get a little bit of a sense. And also, I find it fascinating to contrast, right, to take a look at what this looked like in the 19th century, right, before anything was really dug out. And one of the first things that really had to be done before any archaeology happened was to figure out where the city of David would be, right? We know the stories. We have the literary evidence about King David and coming and conquering the city and building his palace. But where did all that happen? So today, you know, hindsight is 2020. We look and we say, of course it was here, right? This is near the water. It makes so much sense. People did not always know that. They didn't understand where the city began and what was part of the city. So, for example, if you're a little familiar with Jerusalem, you may know that near Jaffa Gate is a massive structure called the Tower of David, which has been built over many centuries by many different conquerors, none of whom were David, right? David had nothing to do with that. It's all the way on the other side of the city. David clearly did not build the Tower of David. Why did it get his name? Because people didn't necessarily know where anything was. And one of the first really groundbreaking attempts to understand where the city was when you had Captain Charles Warren, we're going to talk about with the water in a minute, who comes and kind of does his own excavations and poking around under the very wary eye of the Turks. And he's the one who really figures out, this is the beginning of the city. He lays the groundwork for everybody who's going to come after him. So many archaeologists who are going to come and dig in this very small area, by the way, most of which has not been excavated, even though there have been so many digs here. So it's just fascinating to think about that evolution. When did people figure out that this was the beginnings of Jerusalem? I noticed somebody put this in the chat. I was just peeking quickly, and it's exactly right, right? I told you all the bad things about Jerusalem. It's a terrible choice, right? Not only is it a terrible choice for all sorts of kind of objective reasons, it's a terrible choice for King David, because he's got his stronghold in Hebron, deep in the heart of Judah. Why would he want to go to a place that's not deep within where his allies and his friends are, right? And even if he did, why wouldn't he choose to go somewhere like in the center of the country, like Shiloh, which had been the capital for so long, like Shechem, which is really exactly in the center, but he doesn't choose any of those places. He chooses Jerusalem. And there are those who will say, certainly the rabbis, Chazal, will say, well, he chooses it because he knows that this is ultimately the place where the temple is going to be built. The text doesn't talk about that. The Midrash talks about that a lot, but the text doesn't talk about that. What the text does talk about is how when he becomes king in Jerusalem, like I said before, he rules over everybody. Now, why does he rule over everybody? You have to go back to those boring parts of the book of Joshua that tell you the Nachalot, that tell you where does everybody have their tribal portion. And if you read it carefully, you will realize that Jerusalem is exactly on the border between Judah and Benjamin. And in fact, the border goes in Geben Hinnom, and it goes on the Temple Mount. The rabbis even say the Temple Mount is divided in half. The altar is in the area of Benjamin. The rest of it is the courtyards are in the area of Judah, right? We don't have to get down to that level of resolution. But the idea that this is a city that is divided between the two great rivals, right? Saul comes from Benjamin. David comes from Judah. This is a way to bring them together. Not to mention that you have to conquer the outsiders in order to make this the capital. And outsiders always bring us together, right? We all fight with each other until we have an outside enemy. So getting rid of the outsiders, choosing a place that belongs to both of these rival tribes, it's really a stroke of genius, right? It's a brilliant idea, and it's meant to bring the tribes together. You could ask, does it work, right? Now, if you look in the short term, not really. Meaning the tribes are united. We've seen how fractious they were in the Book of Judges, right? They're still not exactly getting along so well, even in the time of King Saul. They unite under the leadership of King David. They stay united under the leadership of his son Solomon. And then the next generation, it all falls apart, right? By the time of David's grandson, Rehoboam, that's it. We have a kingdom of Israel. We have the kingdom of Judah, and the twain shall not meet, and they never reunite, right? So in the short term, doesn't work so well. In the long term, Jerusalem remains the capital of Israel. It doesn't lose that status as the capital even today, right? Even throughout the many, many years of exile. And David does succeed at that, because what he does is, when he flees Jerusalem in the time of the rebellion of Absalom, he refuses to take the ark with him. He says the ark stays in Jerusalem, because Jerusalem is the final capital, the most important capital of the Jewish people forever. And that actually did work, right? And we still pray towards Jerusalem and talk about Jerusalem and mention it all the time. So he was successful, perhaps not in the short term, but in the long term. So how does he do this, right? We keep mentioning this text. Let's look at this text for a minute. Okay, I'm going to read it in the English, but you also have it in the Hebrew if you want, right? In the beginning of the fifth chapter of the second book of Samuel, David was 30 years old when he became king, and he reigned for 40 years, right? We have this very nice division here helping us to understand his kingship. In Hebron, and this is the verse that I was telling you before, he reigned over Judah 7 years and 6 months. He reigned over Judah. And in Jerusalem, he reigned over all Israel and Judah for 33 years, right? This is the uniting capital. Now we're going to get the story of the conquest. And you're like, okay, great. I really want to understand that. It's not going to help you so much. The king and his men set out for Jerusalem against the Jebusites who inhabited the region. David was told, and here's this very strange verse, you will never get in here. Even the blind and the lame will turn you back. Right? Now, this is a very liberal translation. If you look at the verse in Hebrew, right, Pasuk Vav, Vayelech HaMelech Vanashav Yushalayim Ela Yivusi Yoshev Haaretz, right, that part already we have, same translation. Vayomer LeDavid, and they said to David, Lemor, Lo Tavo Hena, you will not come in here, Ki Im Hesircha HaIvrim VaHapischim Lemor Lo Yavo David Hena, unless you get rid of the blind and the lame who say David cannot come here. This is a strange verse. What does it mean? All right. So many of the commentaries look at this. They say, oh, what did the Jebusites do? Of course, they're idol worshipers. They put their idols up on the walls of the city. And those are the blind and the lame, right? We, of course, don't believe in idols. The idols are, you know, they have legs, but they can't walk. They have eyes, but they can't see. And the Jebusites are taunting him and saying, you get rid of our idols. That's how you'll get in, right? They obviously don't call them the blind and the lame. Other commentaries say, no, it goes back to an alliance from the time of Abraham, right? All different kinds of possibilities. The simplest way to explain this verse to me is that the Jebusites basically are all the way up. Remember that Mitzudat Zion, that fortress of Zion, we're going to see in the very next verse. And they're looking down at David and his men all the way down in the valley. And they say, you know what? Even if the blind and the lame were defending our fortress, you couldn't get in here. You have no chance. Our fortress is impregnable. However, Vayokod David at Mitzudat Zion, he ir David. David captured the stronghold of Zion. It is now the city of David. How does he do this? We'll give a possible answer later, connected to what happens next. David said, those who attack the Jebusites shall reach the water channel, right? The Tsinor, what does that mean? The water channel. We'll try to give an answer, but he occupies the Mitzudah, the stronghold. He renames it the city of David, and he fortifies the surrounding area, and he builds himself a palace, right? I didn't put that in English for some reason. I apologize. Vayishlach Hiram melech Tzor melechim el David va'atzei arazim, right? The king of Tyre, Hiram, sends David all these materials, vayivnu bayit leDavid, and he builds himself his own palace. He doesn't want to live in the fortress. He wants to live in his own palace. So what do we get from these verses? We get a little bit of a sense of the power of the Jebusites. We get maybe a possible explanation about how the city was conquered. And we understand that the city is meant to be a unifying force. Okay. Now, how do they do this? What is this touching the pipe? Baiga Batsinor. So this handsome gentleman is Captain Charles Warren. He's a 19th century, one of the fascinating 19th century Christian, right? Some of them British, a few Americans, who come to explore the land of Israel. This is the very beginnings of archaeology. He's a Philo-Semite. He's a Zionist before there's such a thing as Zionism. And as you can see, he is a decorated military man. And he comes to Jerusalem and he starts to do a little poking around. And I call it poking around and not archaeology because the Turks are in charge. They don't like this. They don't want digging. They suspect everybody of being an enemy and of trying to invade them and to undermine them. So most of what he does has to be kind of on the sly. And he goes down to the city of David. He knows where the water is. And he asks people, is there actually like some direct access to the water? Because as we're going to see in a minute, the water has been moved. And they say, yeah, yeah, above the actual, you know, source of the spring, there's like an opening, a shaft, and Warren, who is a very determined fellow, goes and with his assistant, they climb this shaft, which is about 8 meters, right? About 25 feet high. They climb up to the top and they discover from there a tunnel that leads out into the city. And basically what they say is, aha, this is what David did. He sent his general Yoav up the Tsinor, the water pipe, and he was then able to sneak into the city because this was like a shortcut for the girls of the city to get their water. He was able to sneak into the city, open up the gates, and the army came pouring in. We're going to see that Warren got it not 100% right, but his theory is very possibly true, that it, not exactly the way he said it, but perhaps entering through the water system. Now, one of the very interesting excavations of recent years was an archaeologist named Eilat Mazar. She passed away last year. She's a very interesting archaeologist from a family of archaeologists. And she dug at the top above this fortress of Zion. And what she found was a very massive wall with pottery that she dated to the 10th century. And she said, you know what this is? This is David's palace. Other archaeologists did not agree with her. She stood by her guns and she based what she said not only on the archaeology, but on the verses, right? Because remember what we said, David conquers the city. And what does he do? He builds himself a palace. And just a few verses later, we have this interesting statement. When the Philistines heard that David had been anointed king over Israel, they marched in search of David, right? While there was this kind of internecine warfare, the Philistines, you guys kill each other, we don't care. But once there's some unity, then the Philistines are going to come back and attack. So they come to look for David, but David heard of it and he went down to the fastness. Okay, this is an old-fashioned translation. To the fortress, by Yered El Hamitsuda, meaning if he went down to the fortress, the palace was above the fortress. So Eilat Mazar dug above the fortress and she found this structure. Is it really King David's palace? Like I said, we don't have 100% proof. Nobody wrote on the walls in graffiti David was here, but it's an intriguing suggestion. And if it's true, like we said, so many of the stories of the book take place in and around the palace. So that's just a fascinating possibility. Okay, let's move on a little bit from King David and talk a little bit more about what happens to the city. So after David's time, first of all, in David's time, he expands the city, which had been only kind of this area, and he goes to the north, to this area that's called the Ophel, right? Ophel from the Hebrew appeal, to go up, because you are going up, right? And he expands the city. His son, King Solomon, builds the wall even higher, right? And expands the city to include what we are going to call the area of the Temple Mount. He builds himself a palace and he builds the temple. Later, as time passes, the city wall is built all the way down to encompass the area of the water, The earlier wall did not do that. And eventually, the city's going to expand all the way to the west. Okay, but we're not up to that yet. So we have the Jebusite city, we have King David's addition, we have Solomon's addition, and then we have a much later addition of the wall that goes all the way down into the valley. This is obviously an artist's rendering, and there are things that are incorrect, but there's a lot that's correct and helpful. Okay, a fascinating question that archaeologists talked about a lot until 1967 without any way of proving one way or another was, at what point does the city grow, right? We know that in David's time and Solomon's time, the city is this big, right? This picture here on the left, this narrow, long tongue. We know that in Second Temple times, the city includes this whole area to the west. But at what point does that happen? Does that happen in First Temple times already, or does it not happen until the time of the Hasmoneans? And there were two schools of thought. There were the minimalists, the guys that said, no, all the time of the First Temple and all the time of early Second Temple, the city is this long, narrow strip and it doesn't expand. And there were the maximalists who said, no, already by late First Temple times, the city expanded all the way to what today we call Jaffa Gate, right? The whole area of the Jewish quarter. And it was all very big. And everybody had their opinion and everybody had arguments like Jews like to do, but nobody had any proof, right? Because the only way to have proof is to actually excavate this area and see if there's stuff from First Temple times. But that's a little bit of a problem because this is deep in the heart of the old city, the Jewish quarter. How could you excavate it? There's houses there. There's people there. You can't just dig it up, right? History, God gave us a gift that was wrapped up in a tragedy. In 1948, the War of Independence, the Jewish quarter is lost. The old city is lost. The Jews have to leave. The Jordanians take over. They destroy the massive buildings that are there, the synagogues, the Horva Synagogue and the Tiferet Yisrael, but they don't build very much. And in 1967, when Israel comes back, essentially the Jewish quarter is a lot of rubble and they have to decide how to rebuild it. And they make a very, very significant decision, which is that while they're rebuilding, they're also going to excavate. And in excavating, they found incredible things. It's a subject for another class. But one of the things they found was this enormous wall, which we think went as tall as this, right? Very nice tall wall, 8 meters high, with pottery and with the style of the construction dating back to First Temple times. And Nachman Abigad, who is the archaeologist who dug here, said this is proof positive that the maximalists are correct, that the city really did expand already in First Temple times. When? Probably in the time of King Hezekiah, Chizkiyahu, when the city grows because you have all the refugees who are coming from the Northern Kingdom, which has been conquered by the Assyrians, and the city grows and he builds the wall and he moves the water and all sorts of interesting things. Okay, let's go back to our Ir David, because the city stays, the focus of the city, the most important part of the city is still down there. Okay, and this is what we saw before, our stepped stone structure, our house of Achiel, okay, and our boule, our seals that are down here, and the evidence of destruction. Okay, so we are going to take a look at some of the pieces here. We looked at the stepped stone structure. Now let's take a look at the house. Right now, today it doesn't look like much because it's on. A lot of it has been destroyed. But essentially, this was what's called a four-room house, which was the style, the architectural style in First Temple times. Okay, but it was a very fancy four-room house. It had two stories. You can see there's a staircase here. All right, can you see the staircase? This is the inner courtyard, and there are rooms all around. Hey, we call it the House of Achiel because they found something written there that says Achiel. Was it Achiel's house? Did the guy owe Achiel money? We don't know. Hey, probably the most famous thing about this house, which for some reason is cut off in this picture, but you saw it in the previous picture, is it has a toilet next to it, right? Having a toilet in First Temple Times next to your house meant that you were very wealthy because you had a servant who was going to clean out that toilet all the time, right? So this is a house of somebody who has a lot of money. But what's the most fascinating thing about it is that it had, did I have this in the next picture? I don't remember. Let's find out. They found all sorts. Oh, here's our toilet. Sorry, I take it back. I did. How could we not give, you know, kavod to the toilet? Okay, so the toilet, very, very important. Toilets are always very exciting in archaeology. But they also found all sorts of idols in the house. Now, is Achiel a Jew living in Judea and going to the temple, which is a 5-minute walk away? For sure. Does Achiel also have a little fertility goddess in his back room just in case? For sure. How come I'm so sure? Because that's what the prophets talk about throughout Tanakh, right? People believed in both. People followed both. So Achiel is a great example of what all these prophets are talking about, right? Jeremiah talks about how you come to the temple and you think everything's going to be okay, but meanwhile, you do whatever you like, including idolatry, including murder, including theft, and you think it's all going to be okay. It's not going to all be okay. So that's Achiel's house. The other thing that was found here that was very, very exciting was a cache of 51 boule, right? Boule are seal impressions. In the old days, if you wanted to send a letter, you wrote your letter, you rolled it up, you took a piece of clay, and you sealed it, and then you sent it with a messenger to whoever you wanted to send it to, right? But who's to say that the messenger is not going to stop along the way and read your letter and sell its contents to anybody who might want it? So in order to prevent that from happening, anyone important has a personal seal. Often it's a signet ring, right? And this is throughout. This is not just in the land of Israel. This is throughout the ancient Near East. People had seals in other countries. They tended to be very beautiful and very elaborate. The Jews were not so big on the plastic arts, and they didn't have beautiful seals, but they did have seals that had names on them, because how else do you personalize it? You put your name on it. So we find all of these names. Most of them are names that we don't recognize, but they still give us a lot of information. Sometimes you have a title. You have all kinds of interesting things, right? Sometimes you have names that actually appear in Tanakh. And one of the names that was discovered here, and that's this, you can see it in the nice ancient Hebrew letters, is a guy named Gemariahu ben Shafan. He was the scribe to one of the last kings of Judah, King Jehoiakim. And this is his seal. And we found two other seals in the palace area, also with names from the book of Jeremiah, Gedaliah ben Pashchur, why is it escaping me? I don't remember it right now. Okay, but not particularly important characters, but it's neat to see the names. Why do we have so many of these seal impressions in one place? Because we think that this was an archive, right? Everybody who made a contract or a letter or something that was sent to the king, a copy was kept in the archive, sealed with the author's seal. And at some point, probably during the conquest of the city by the Babylonians, the archive is set on fire. The letters, the contracts, the documents all burn up, but the seals are made of clay. So the seals just harden and last forever. So they're a very interesting hello from the past. Okay, let's move in a different direction. And now we're really going away from King David, but it's important. Okay? At the bottom of the city of David, as we said before, is the Kidron Valley. And the Kidron Valley is already outside the city. We see this from a few different places. We see it from the fact that once you leave the, cross the Kidron, right? We have a few stories. King David crosses the Kidron when he's fleeing from Absalom. Later, you have a character in the Book of Kings named Shimei ben Gera, who leaves the city by crossing the Kidron. Once you cross the Kidron, you've left the city, right? It's the city limits. Now, because it's the city limits, people are buried there because you can't be buried within the city because impurity, right? Jews are big on impurity, but right outside the city, you're not going to go so far away. So right outside the city, you will be buried. And there's a whole bunch of burial caves and monuments down in the Kidron Valley, some really impressive ones from Second Temple times, like Yad Avshalom, but some much more modest ones from First Temple times that are essentially caves, right? You can see them here, the holes cut into the side of the mountain. One impressive one is what looks like a little house. This is actually 3,000 years old. It's called Kever Bat Paro, Paro's daughter's grave. It has nothing to do with Paro. Basically, the Arabs, anything that looked a little bit strange, they connected to Egypt and Egyptians. I always compare it to like when we you were growing up, anything strange was Chinese, right? Chinese jump rope, Chinese jacks. That was for the Arabs, that's Egyptian. So it's not connected to Paro. It's a first temple period monumental grave. There's a little bit left of an inscription in Hebrew letters, but that's about it. People were buried with stuff. All right. They were laid out. Their bodies were laid out. The bodies disintegrated. The bones are put into a common place, but they're also buried with stuff. But archaeologists almost never find stuff because grave robbers find it first. And one of the things that was discovered in these graves in the Kidron Valley, they didn't find any stuff, but they found a fascinating inscription. You can see it, right? It's this beautiful Ketav Ivri, the Hebrew letters, except for the part that's erased in the middle, which is very sad, because what does it say? Zot, this is probably Kfurat, the grave of something Yahu, something Yahu. Oh, hooray. Yeshayahu, Yirmiyahu, Chizkiyah, everybody in Tanakh is a something Yahu. So who is this Yahu? But we have another little bit of a clue. He has a title, Asher al-Habayit. Asher al-Habayit is sort of like a secretary of state, right? A cabinet minister. We hear about it a few times in Tanakh. We have a guess as to who this might be. It might be a character named Shevna, who's in the time of Isaiah. But what's interesting for us is the continuation of the inscription. It says, Ein po kesef v'zahav. Nothing to look for here. There's no gold. There's no silver. Grave robbers, move along. There's only bones here. Kim atzmato v'atzmot amato imo. It's only his bones and the bones of his servant. There's nothing here. And just in case you didn't believe that, Arur ha'adam asher yiftach etzeh. Cursed is the person who opens this. Neither of these things worked. The grave was robbed, but it's a great testimony to how people thought about how they could protect themselves. Okay, let's go back to our water, right? Remember we talked about Warren, right? And Warren says that there was this tunnel. The Jebusites were very clever. They understood that the water was all the way at the bottom of the city. They didn't want to build a wall all the way at the bottom of the city because then it's vulnerable to be attacked, to be scaled. So they built the wall a little bit up the slope, but then the water is outside the city. How do you get your water while remaining safe? So what they did is they cut out a massive tunnel, and it's truly impressive to see what was done almost 4,000 years ago. They cut out this massive tunnel where you could go down and essentially go outside the city, but you were underground, so it wasn't dangerous. And at the end of the tunnel is this shaft. Remember, he climbs up from the bottom to the top and discovers the shaft. And he assumes that this is how the girls got their water, and he assumes that this is how the city was breached by King David. But about, why, it's almost 30 years ago, there was a new discovery that was made. No. 20 years ago, in the end of the 1990s, there was a new discovery that was made, and they discovered that the tunnel doesn't end by the shaft, but it actually goes all the way down to the water. And there's another protection that's called the spring house, these massive towers. All of this is still something of a work in progress. We're discovering new things along the way. But basically, the Jebusites, almost 4,000 years ago, built an enormous, sophisticated system taking you from the center of the city underground to the spring where you came out into the open, to a pool. But you were protected by these huge towers. Does this ruin Warren's theory? Not really, because basically all David had to do was knock off the guards in the tower and then continue into the tunnel. He doesn't even have to climb up a shaft, right? So that actually works even better. And this system lasts for a long, long time. It lasts until the time of King Hezekiah, okay, the 700s BCE, where for various reasons, he decides to move the water, right? He doesn't build a tunnel for people. He builds a tunnel for water, okay? He moves the water from the Gihon spring in a very kind of zigzaggy way to a pool that is called the Shiloh pool, and he covers up the source, the Gihon spring, so that nobody talks about the Gihon anymore. They talk about the Shiloh. Now, why does he do this? He does it for two reasons. One is written about in the text. He's about to fight the Assyrians. The Assyrians are going to come. This is right near the edge of the city, and the text says, Lama yavoha ashurim v'yimtzu mayim rabim. Why should the Assyrians come and find all this water? Right here we are at the edge of the city. They're going to come. They're going to poison our water supply. They're going to cut off our water supply. So we better hide the source and move the water. That's the explicit reason in the text. The other reason is that by this point, the city has expanded. There's a whole population living over here on the Western Hill. For them to go all the way down and all the way up and all the way down again to get their water, that's a big pain. So he can't make the water go uphill. All right. So nobody can do that at this stage of history, but he can make a quicker route to the water. So King Hezekiah changes this. If you've ever gone to the city of David and walked through Hezekiah's tunnel, this is the tunnel that you walk through. But again, when it was made, it wasn't meant for people. It was meant only for water. And it changes the whole system from what it had been for literally thousands of years to something completely different. And the whole Jebusite system kind of stops being used. Now, the most fascinating thing that was discovered in this tunnel was discovered at the very beginning of the 20th century by some kids who were poking around in the tunnel, and they uncovered this inscription. If you want to see this inscription, you will have to make your way to Istanbul, where it is in the museum there, because the Turks were here and they took it home. Hey, it's a fascinating inscription, again, in our good old Hebrew letters. What is it? It's the story of the tunnel, right? And I brought it to you here in English. This is the story of the tunnel. While the axes were against each other, and while 3 cubits were left to cut, right? 3 cubits, shalosh amot, an amma is about 1.5 feet. Okay, so about 4.5 feet, not very much. The voice of a man called to his counterpart, "What's going on? How do you dig this tunnel very quickly?" You start from two ends, right? And you meet in the middle. Why do you not miss each other? That's the continuation. There was a tzaddik, right? Probably a crack, a natural crack in the rock, and they were just following it, right? If you look back, you'll see it's not a straight line. It's a very curvy tunnel because they're following a crack in the rock. And on the day of the tunnel, the stonecutter struck each man towards his counterpart, axe against axe, and the water flowed from the source to the pool, right? It's an amazing inscription. Why? For a few reasons. First of all, just that whole image. One group puts down their axes and they hear the voice of a man calling to his counterpart, Kol Ish Koreo Re'eu. You can really feel like you're there. Okay. It tells you how it was made. And to me, the most exciting part of it is it has nobody signs it. There's no signature. This is not written by the king. This is not written by the cabinet minister. This isn't even written by the foreman of the work crew. This is somebody who is working on this, who thinks it's important enough to write this story down. And that's fascinating because this is a terrible job. You don't want this job. It's really dangerous. You're digging underground. It might all collapse on you. This is a job that's maybe for slaves, certainly for people who are like at the lower end of the society's rungs. And yet somebody there knows how to read and write. And somebody there has a sense of history. And that's just a fascinating testimony to what ancient Israel is like. Okay. At the end of the tunnel, if you've ever gone through the tunnel, you come out into this pool. This pool is not from First Temple times. Where was the Shiloh pool of First Temple times? We don't really know. It does not seem to exist anymore. This is from Byzantine times. There was a church here. It was important to them as well. But again, in the late 90s, the early 2000s, there was a discovery made of the Shiloh pool of Second Temple times, this big, massive pool. We hear about it a lot in rabbinic literature. This is where the water is brought for pouring out the water on the altar in the temple. This is where people would come when they came on pilgrimage. And today you could go see this pool, the Second Temple period pool. Okay, just a few last things about Ir David, and then I just want to do one quick thing about King David again. The city of David remains important in Second Temple times. Today, there are excavations that are unearthing the main road that went from the Shiloh pool and up towards the foot of the temple round, the Pilgrim's Road, and you can walk on part of it, and they're still excavating more and excavating underneath, and it's really very cool. Okay, this is also Second Temple times. This is a quarry, but there was also a discovery of an inscription that talks about a synagogue in the city of David at the time the temple is standing. The area was neglected for hundreds and hundreds of years. In the 19th century, the Yemenites who come to the land of Israel come and basically get no help from the Jewish community that's here already in Jerusalem. And they move into the caves, those burial caves that we saw. They move into the caves in the Kidron Valley. And it's only later in the late 19th century that we get some Jewish purchasing of land here. And it's only 100 years after that, in the 1990s, that Jews start to come and live in the city of David and enable the excavations that are happening here. Okay, one last thing. And again, I didn't spend much time on it because I did do a whole class on it last year. One of the big questions in biblical archaeology, like we said, well, we know there was a King David, but how powerful a king was he, right? The Bible talks about him as a very powerful king who has a huge kingdom. Hey, more recently, in the last 30, 40 years, archaeologists have said, no. If anything, he was a tribal chieftain. And today, we're starting to excavate more places that seem to indicate that he did have more power, perhaps not as much as the Bible tells us, but certainly he wasn't just ruling over this tiny little city of David. And one of the most intriguing discoveries is out in what's called the Elah Valley, right, west of Jerusalem, near Beit Shemesh. There's a city discovered called Kaiapha, which we think is the biblical city of Sha'arayim. It was a very well-planned city with a nice wall. You could see the wall in this aerial photo all around it with gates, two gates, by the way, Sha'arayim, two gates, very unusual. It dates to the time of King David, and it seems, at least according to the archaeologist, to be belonging to Judah as opposed to being Philistine or Canaanite. And if this is true, and if this is correct, you have an outpost of King David's kingdom, okay, more than a half a day's walk from Jerusalem, okay, going out towards the west, going out towards the land of the Philistines, a powerful centralized city that had writing, right? We found writing here. This is a jug that says on it, Eshbaal ben Bidan, that had a tax system. These are jar handles that were used for tax collection, that had ritual objects that resembled what the temple is going to look like. Okay? And it's a very intriguing possibility that this was built by King David and showing us yet another element to his power. Okay? So that's really, there's much more to talk about there, but that's just to give us a little bit of a taste. Let's see if people had questions. Okay. David Batsheva. For 19 years, the Jewish quarter remained in rubble. Yes, I did a whole class on it last year. They built, but they built very little. They didn't need to realize they had the whole old city. They had the whole East Jerusalem. They didn't have any great desire to build. The Muslim quarter was much more important. It's right near the Temple Mount. It was not necessary for them. So they built a little bit, but they didn't build anything massive. They didn't build anything that couldn't just be knocked down, right? No big buildings. Is there a rendering of what this would look like fully built? I'm sorry, I don't remember what that is referring to. So whoever wrote the question, ask what it is. I don't know. Or you can write another message. Chizkiyahu's tunnel is winding rather than straight because of what I said, it's following this natural crack in the rock. The pilgrimage road, you can go in part of it at the very beginning. You can go underground in the sewers. If you're super VIP, you can go a little bit more. But the plan is that ultimately it's all going to be open. They just have to make it safe enough for people to travel on. The four-room house. Yes, I do have a picture of what the four-room house looks like. I do not have it here. If you send me an email, I will send it to you, or I will try to bring it next time. You are very welcome to send me an email. I'll put my email in again. Okay, any other questions people have? Comments? Okay, thank you. Thank you, Maxine.
Justin, yes. Hi, Shuli.
Hi. Hi, Ruchama.
Just to give you a yishar koach about another one. It's just beautiful and amazing.
Thank you. Four-room house. Okay, I'm going to write it down for myself to do it for next week so that I remember. Otherwise, I will not remember. We'll start next time. I'll show it for everybody so everybody can see because it actually is very important. Okay? Thank you, Maxine. You want to do announcements?
Sure. Tonight at 8:30 p.m., Rabbi Mordechai Tortiner of Beit Midrash Zichron Dov here in Toronto will be giving a shiur on the Parsha. And tomorrow morning at 9:30 a.m., Rabbi Kelman will be giving his shiur on the Siddur.
Sorry, Maxine, 9:30 or 9?
Oh, 9. Excuse me. Thank you for the correction. Thank you again to Lee Snitzer for sponsoring today's class in memory of his father, Mordechai Ben Raphael. If we don't see you later this week, then have a Shabbat Shalom and see you next time. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Shabbat Shalom, everyone.
Shabbat Shalom, and thank you again.
Shabbat Shalom.